the future has arrived. As the world and humanity itself moves faster and faster into unimaginable possibilities, old institutions that built connection and shaped our sense of meaning are falling by the wayside. In their wake, profound questions about ethics, our purpose, and spirituality demand new answers. Join your host, Scott Mason, in Season 2 of the Purpose Highway Podcast. We will explore how these social changes will revolutionize our society. We will learn how they impact our own search for connection and meaning. And we will hear stories of influencers whose lives have had radical change from the inside and found profound connection to others and themselves through a new definition of meaning. The future has arrived. Are you ready?
When you're racing down the purpose highway, we want to make sure you're healthy and happy every step of the way. That's why we're proud to partner with It's Nola, 21st century plant-based healthy granola snack bites made with real ingredients and audacious flavor. It's Nola crafts small batch hand-rolled granola balls that are vegan, gluten-free, and naturally low in sugar. It's Nola's delightful bites come in three flavors: luscious cranberry coconut, sassy mango masala, and dark, decadent, chewy chocolate. It's Nola is available to both individual customers and for wholesale accounts at itsnola.com. That's itsnola.com. Guests on this show are already enjoying this delicious snack. Check out It's Nola's website for yourself and find out how good it is. Hello, everybody. It's Scott Mason revving up for another race down the Purpose Highway. Now, if you like what we're doing, be sure to subscribe and give us a thumbs up on YouTube or a review on Apple. In the meantime, sitting next to me today in the front seat is Brian Gorman. Brian is a transformational coach who works with his clients to discover, connect, or reconnect to their purpose, and then to live into it. He has a BA in cultural anthropology from Syracuse University, a MA in higher education administration from the University of Texas at San Antonio, and a MA in human relations from the University of Oklahoma. He is also an International Coach Federation professional certified coach, a board member of the Gay Coaches Alliance, and a certified LGBT business enterprise. If that weren't enough, Brian is a TEDx speaker and the author of not one, not two, not even three, 24 articles for the Forbes Coaches Council. Brian, it is great to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. It is always great to be in conversation with you.
And we are going to have a heck of a chit-chat today. Brian, let's just keep it real and start with the theme of the show and how you and your work relates to it. We are in the middle of a silent revolution of thought. The historical organizations that have tethered us to each other, built connections through the search for meaning, are in decline, and many believe they are not coming back, particularly those that tether us to ethics and spirituality and a common sense of purpose. We are also enduring a secret plague of alienation that has come from the disconnect that occurs when people don't have shared spaces to build relationships centered around the search for meaning. The decline of these historical institutions, including religious ones, is, according to the data that I've researched, as well as the informed information that prior guests have provided to those who watch and listen to this show, driven in no small part by major generational shifts. And with that in mind, knowing what I do about you and hearing everything that I just had froth out of my mouth like a wild man, talk to me about whether you agree with what I said and why, with your focus on young people as a coach, you believe that that group needs coaching more than ever, particularly of the type that you provide, relating to purpose.
So, I absolutely agree with you in terms of the shifts that are taking place, Scott. And I would maybe expand on or at least state explicitly that it's not just the spiritual institutions. We're undergoing a great resignation in the workplace where workers are saying, I'm not going back to the way it was.
Yeah.
Which puts people again out into the world, if you will, without those social connections that they had in the workplace. Our ability to live in this world and to adapt to this change is based on our resilience, our ability to recalibrate to what's happening around us. And our resilience is fueled by four energies: physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. And over again, as I'm working with my clients, I hear about declines and depletion in each of those areas. And people know what to do to replenish their physical energy. I need to sleep more. I need to exercise more. I need to rest more. The same with mental and emotional. When we begin to talk about spiritual energy, people get flustered. They don't know where that has come from in their lives. And it's so interesting. I was working with one client, and yes, I work with a lot of younger clients. In this case, it was somebody who was actually in her 70s and had spent her life in academia, in the realm of spirituality. And when we got to spiritual energy, she said, I don't know where it comes from. And so we did some exploration, and she realized that going to walk in her garden replenished her spiritual energy, reconnected her with nature. At the time, she had a dog who was a longtime companion who was dying, and having that dog on her lap while she worked and her hands just stroking that dog refueled her spirit. So I agree with you that there's a void here that needs filling. As to the second part of your question around working with younger people, the back in 2018, I guess it was, Gallup published a research report on the way that millennials want to work and live.
Yes.
And they identified six significant organizational shifts that needed to take place if organizations were to attract and retain millennials. That was the voice of millennials in 2018. It is the voice of the Great Resignation now. And one piece of that shift was from my job to my life. And again, that speaks to, at all ages, the importance of people reconnecting to purpose.
Which, if I'm hearing you correctly, is very closely tied to the concept of spiritual energy being replenished. There's been a lot of talk about the Great Resignation, and for those who might be listening to this or watching this years down the road, to be clear about what the Great Resignation is, we're taping this at the tail end, well, Who knows whether it's a tail end? I'm hoping it's a tail end. That was an optimistic or aspirational statement, if there ever was one. We are taping this during one of the later phases of the COVID epidemic. And the Great Resignation is referring to a lot of the information out there in the business and employment sector around huge numbers of people just leaving their jobs. And from what I've read about the Great Resignation, a lot of it is exactly as you've suggested, fueled by people not feeling connected to their purpose. So obviously it isn't about money. No one is saying that it is about them not feeling physically fit or any of these other things. It is talking about the lack of connection within the work community to spirituality itself. All of this, though, raises a question that I really like to dive into with guests, and I feel like you might be uniquely equipped to answer it based on your background. And that is, what exactly is spiritual energy? On the one hand, you hear about it all the time. I'm not feeling spiritually connected. My spirit isn't feeling nourished. On the other hand, spiritual energy also has this nebulousness about it. It can also be associated in common parlance with woo-woo or people believing that if you wave crystals around, all of a sudden magical things are going to happen and you'll feel good again. When you talk about spiritual energy, because this will be discussed throughout our conversation today, what exactly do you mean in the most concrete terms possible?
There's a contradiction between concrete and spirit.
Then go for it. Challenge me.
What I'm talking about is feeding our souls, feeding our sense of purpose, mm-hmm. Feeding our sense of something bigger than ourselves. Mm-hmm. And you know, for some, it's God or Allah or Buddha, and for others, it's nature or it's Mother Nature and Mother Earth and Father Sky or, you know, the Great Turtle, or it could be any number of things, but it's spiritual energy comes into us from the world beyond us, and gives us a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose, a sense of why I'm here in the world and what difference I make. Mm-hmm. To the world around me.
Mm-hmm. That's a powerful statement, the last part in particular, because I have yet in my life to hear, I could be wrong, but I've yet in my life to hear anyone say, I want my entire existence to be meaningless. My goal in life is to have this one chance that I have at living to be completely pointless. And so if I'm hearing, yes, please.
If I can interrupt you, I'm not sure I've heard anybody say it, and I don't know how many countless lives I've seen live it.
Mm.
You know, I'm living until I can retire, and then I'll find life. Or, you know, just another day, just another paycheck, just another day, just another paycheck. So people may not be saying it, and they are living it.
They are living it. Two things that raises. Thank you so much for saying this. Another thing about the date of this episode being recorded is that it is 2 days prior to the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And the reason why I raise that is because I was very close to the World Trade Center when it went down. And if there's anything that I think about, it's hard for me not to get emotional about this. There were thousands of people that day that went to work, and I bet a lot of them did it just for the paycheck, day after day, thinking I'll retire. And they went into the office, did whatever routine things that they did waiting for that retirement. The next thing you know, they were jumping from 100 floors. And so it's a hard thing for me to think about when you say that, particularly considering the time when this conversation's occurring. The second thing that what you said reminds me of is a mentor of mine when I worked for government. And this also brings me pain. Maybe I'm feeling pain, though, that doesn't need to be felt. He told me after he retired, I have come to realize and accept that nothing I did during my entire career mattered. Nothing. I had no impact. Anything that I did, someone else could have done. And at this point in my life, I'm okay with that. I don't know, Brian. When he told me that, that also just broke my heart. He's so smart, has so much energy, so much to bring to the world. I share these stories sometimes because I throw them out there and guests have reactions. I'd love to hear your reactions to those stories.
You remind me of a person I dated just once.
Does that say you would have only gone on one date with me?
No, not you, but your story.
Oh.
And he asked me about me, and I began to tell him my story. And as you know from my TEDx talk, I really became engaged with change when I was a freshman at Syracuse University and doing volunteer work on the Onondaga Reservation and then fighting the university to change its mascot, and got drafted out of graduate school, and I was a drill sergeant and went back to work in higher education and then management consulting and on and on and on. And I sort of flew over my story at a very high level and then asked him about himself. And he said, well, coming out of college, I went to work for the New York Thruway Authority. I retired from the Thruway Authority 5 years ago and had a love affair with my sofa. Wow. When that wore out, I went back as a contractor now to the Thruway Authority. Different lives.
Yeah.
Different, you know, as I explored that story with him, there was no purpose in that life other than the paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And when he could get the paycheck without working, he had a love affair with his sofa.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine saying, I have a love affair with my sofa.
Yeah.
I know there are so many things I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
So that's that story.
Do you feel that if someone is hearing that story and sees themselves in it, or they feel themselves in it, what would you even tell them to begin to do?
First, put aside age.
Yeah.
I became a coach in my mid-60s, Scott. I've had, as I just flew over, multiple careers in my life.
Yeah, I love that, by the way. I completely relate.
The woman I was talking about earlier was in her 70s when she came to me. And she said, I'm burned out on my old career. I'm retired. I'm going to be really pissed at myself if I'm sitting around doing nothing for the next 20 years. Help me find my passion.
Yeah.
Age doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
We all have something inside of us that makes our heart sing when we connect to it.
Do you agree with the Scott Mason radical opinion that I'm more than happy to shout everywhere, including in this moment, that we actually have an ethical obligation to pursue our passions, find what they are, go for it?
Ooh. That question gives me pause, because my answer is yes, and I'm not quite sure about how much authority I have to impose that on others.
Yeah. Well, we will talk then about some things that you have the most definitive authority on, your life. So going back to the original subject of the silent revolution of thinking around religion, spirituality, ethics, and connection to purpose in the connective atmospheres that historical institutions have provided, as well as the theme of generational change that we discussed at the top of the hour. Is it fair to say that you were an early herald of what was to come around the changing nature of spirituality in the Western world and beyond?
In many aspects of my life, I've tended to be sort of over the horizon from the masses in front. And so that probably is a true statement as well, Scott. Yeah.
You have a very unusual spiritual grounding that we will discuss in a few minutes. But that spiritual ethos was not always who you were. You were raised in the Episcopal Church. Is that correct?
Correct.
And I would love to hear a little bit about your experience, particularly if you have any thoughts growing up in that tradition as to why young people, well, people across the board, are leaving mainline Protestantism in particular in droves.
I can only speak for me.
Talk.
So, if I had known you were going to bring this up, I could have brought up my 10-year attendance pin. There's a little seal in the middle with the Episcopal shield, and that has a wreath outside, and then different shaped banners hanging below. And I left that practice for a very practical reason at the time. And I think this probably does play for many people. I can remember in before we were in the church, when we were in the kids thing, and being taught how we were the chosen, and thinking, what makes me so special and different mm-hmm. from all of my friends?
I'm
not perfect. I'm certainly not Christ-like. I'm a little kid who does things right and does things wrong.
Yeah.
And that questioning, which is so much a part of being a child, I think, tended to get sort of taught out of you.
Mm-hmm.
I left for college in the fall of 1971. It was the Vietnam era. I was 17 years old, and I had a very conflicted feeling about the Vietnam War. My father was a World War II vet, and he had very different feelings. And so before I left, I met with my minister in a private conversation about what do I do when it's time for me to register for the draft.
Yeah.
And in essence, his counsel was less than wise, and it was less than wise not in telling me that I should follow my conscience,
mm-hmm.
but it was less than wise in telling me not to have that conversation with my father. And so I registered, filed my registration. I don't exactly remember what the process was, but as a conscientious objector, and I was up in Syracuse, and the notice from the draft board came to my parents' home in New Jersey, and my father opened it. And I got a phone call, and it said, you have to come home this weekend and we have to talk, because I used to have two sons and now I have one.
Whoa.
And we talked and I relinquished.
Wow.
We talked and I relinquished. And I faulted my minister mm-hmm. for the advice that he gave me. And I never went back into the Episcopal Church again.
Mm. Yeah. Where did your spiritual journey take you next?
Nowhere for a lot of years. Nowhere intentional, nowhere conscious. I actually did, for a good part of the remainder of that school year and the next school year, attend Mass with a close friend of mine. At times the Mass was in Latin, and I just thought that was such a cool thing. And mm-hmm. you know, you could feel the spiritual energy, even if you couldn't understand the language all the time. But I didn't have a spiritual practice. I didn't have a spiritual practice again until really 2006. I was in churches for weddings and for funerals, or in synagogues for bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. But that was where others were getting fed. It wasn't where I was getting fed. Mm-hmm.
But that is not where you are now.
No.
Well, don't be bashful, Brian.
That's light years.
Everyone is waiting. Where is he?
Another very personal story that up until today I have not ever shared publicly. I was in a relationship with another man for several years. And it was, it started off well, as relationships typically do, but it deteriorated over time. And we both grew to be different people, I think, than we were at the start.
Yeah, happened.
And he became a lot wealthier than me. And so at some point we ran into a conflict over, you know, did I have the right to hold him back from spending his money in ways, you know, like doing incredible things with a weekend home we had bought together and so forth. And I went into this, and I own this state of compromise. If it wasn't critically important to me, he could do what he wanted,
mm-hmm.
you know. He could put in the in-ground pool. He could build the deck with the hot tub. He could, quote wallpaper the dining room in corduroy paisley.
Well, there would have been a line somewhere in my house, but I understand people live different lives.
I know, and literally, he did. And when he hit one of those decade birthdays, he went into a depression that lasted well into the year. And I was struggling with money. We had agreed that I would go out on my own as a professional photographer for a year, and he would help support me. And then some things happened with his family where he was unable to do that. So it was just a lot of struggle and pain. And we had some really big, big, emotionally violent, not physically violent, but emotionally violent conflicts toward the end. And it was March 13th, 2006. Got so bad that I really made the decision to end my life. Mm-hmm. And the good news that day was that I had an appointment with my therapist. Yeah. And he was good. Paul was a good therapist.
So glad to hear that.
And I went home and at the end of the day, my partner came home from work, and everything started from where it had ended before he walked out the door in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it picked up again the next morning. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. And I had the plan. I had the way I was going to be doing it. And I started writing goodbyes to my family, to my then partner, and to my friends. And my therapist called me to check up on me. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, I don't know if I had a cell phone and he came up on caller ID, whether I would have answered or not.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was back in the days of landlines. And I did. And he talked me out of the apartment and up to the hospital where I committed myself. Mm-hmm. And I had friends show up while I was in the emergency room trying to talk me out of it. And I just knew I could not trust myself
yeah.
with my life at that point.
Yeah.
Because as I sat there, I knew I had compromised away everything that had meaning in my life. Mm-hmm. If you have never been there, the pain that you feel leaves you with a feeling that the only way to end the pain is to end the life. Mm-hmm. And so I was in the hospital for just over 2 weeks. And we started doing hospital-safe yoga, for better description. Mm-hmm. You know, yoga sitting in chairs in the mm-hmm. the day room or whatever. And as strange as it sounds, the first thing that really made me feel alive again was one day when I was taking a shower. And feeling the water hitting me and running down me and really connecting with, wow, you know, how many thousands of showers have I taken, have you taken, that you don't even remember them?
Yeah.
And so when I got out of the hospital, it was, I need to commit to myself that I'm never going back there again. Mm-hmm. I need to commit to myself that I'm going to be true to who I am mm-hmm. and to live more fully and more fully and more fully into me and my purpose. Yeah. And so that really was the seed, if you will, that led to what is now my spiritual practice today.
Brian, your current personal spiritual practice melds some Native American and Eastern philosophical and spiritual traditions. Talk to us a little bit about what exactly that looks like to you and how that sort of practice can help people who may be, if they're not exactly where you were the day before you took that shower, they might be somewhere on the continuum between that and really feeling connected to their purpose.
So it has evolved over time. I think other than what it has built out to, I think the biggest evolution was when I ended up with tears in my rotator cuffs because for many years it included yoga. Mm-hmm. Now it includes yoga stretching, but mm-hmm. I can't put a lot of stress on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. But it begins after I do meditation, I do the stretches, and then I move into chanting. And the chanting comes out of my days at the yoga studio. And the chant that I use is the Gayatri Mantra, which is translates approximately to, may the wisdom of the universe and my wisdom be one. Mm-hmm. And I have a mala that I bought when I was in India that is – that so there are 108 Gayatri mantras to begin that piece of the practice. And then I move into, and for anyone listening, this was built for me. This is where I discovered I find my spiritual renewal. And yours may come from completely different sources, and that's okay. And as Scott was introducing it, mine, it doesn't have to be of one tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So I move into, as you said, Scott, a prayer totally of my own conceiving, based on the seven directions that are recognized in many Native American traditions. So I begin facing east, and I give thanks for all the gifts that I will be receiving this day. So it's a prayer of thanksgiving for the opportunities, but not just the opportunities, not just the positives, because the negatives are gifts too. They teach us lessons as well.
Mm-hmm.
So for the opportunities and challenges,
yeah. Yeah.
The joy, the sorrow, and so forth. I then move and turn to face the south. With thanks for all with which I received those gifts, my heart, my mind, my soul, my body, my spirit, my courage, my tenacity, and so forth and so on. And for all the life that I have lived to bring me to this day, because all that life has helped me become the person I am today.
Yeah.
To the west for all the gifts that I will give and all those who will receive them. And to the north, true north, for being my North Star, if you will, guiding me through the day and giving me a place to rest at night. And then to Father Sky, for the sun, the moon, stars, the wind, the rain, the snow, clouds, thunder, lightning, seasons, the very air that we breathe. And then I kneel down to Mother Earth for food, for clothing, for shelter, for the ground we walk on, the water we drink, the fire that lights our way, cooks our food, and keeps us warm. And for nourishing my roots through all these generations. Because if there was just one person in my forefathers and foremothers who weren't nourished, I wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
And then to one, which is my reference to that spirit, that entity, that power, that energy, that whatever it is that is greater than me, and that is always there to feed me. So that's that part of it.
I notice, listening to this, that the imagery that you're describing, or that the practice that you've just laid out for us, has almost a geometric form embedded in it. It's a circle. One of the things that you and I discussed during the pre-interview phase of this conversation was that the spiritual practice that you've chosen to integrate, whether it be via Native American traditions or various Eastern traditions, tends to have a cyclical nature to it. And in contrast, Western spiritual traditions tend to have what I describe as a highly linear approach to spirituality. You described it almost as a birth to death narrative or creation to the end of times. Why does that difference matter? What does it mean to people who might be listening and considering different approaches to connecting to their own spirituality or their own meaning in this universe?
I think there's some validity to both perspectives, first of all. So I don't want to judge either as right or wrong or better or worse or whatever, because I had a beginning and I will have an end. At the same time, and we can sort of chuckle at Walt Disney in a way, but there is this thing called the circle of life.
Mm-hmm.
And my life has an impact on other lives, And when I'm gone, those other lives will still have impact on other lives. And so what I seed grows through others.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, there is that, quote, circle of life that continues. Mm-hmm. And when you find the circle, which is prevalent in so many indigenous traditions, it represents the fact that I'm not just responsible for me. I'm responsible for my children and their children and their children and their children and their children. And that belief makes me a very different citizen in this world.
When I began the second season of this show, focused on the silent revolution, the secret plague, there were many things that I expected to hear as recurring themes. But one that I did not expect to hear, and it's come up over and over again, whether from ethicists or from neurologists who study consciousness, or scholars in the rise of irreligiosity, it is the theme of climate change as a spiritual issue, as an ethical issue, an issue related to meaning itself. You did not mention climate change explicitly, but hearing this, it's very difficult not to take something away about that. I think it's really startling. I never imagined that climate change, of all things, would be one of the key issues that this show would be addressing. Do you have anything to say about what I just spewed out of my mouth?
Yeah, I do. It's you know, the earth will not end, even if life on the earth ends. We may kill ourselves off. The planet will still be here.
Mm-hmm.
That whole circular view of life that I was referring to a few minutes ago, the way it affects how you show up as a citizen because of your commitment and your obligation to future generations. A big part of what that means is how you interact with the environment.
With that in mind, you also said pre-interview that you're passionate about what the future holds. In light of the daily news, the situation with the climate, the secret plague and the silent revolution, and the great resignation and the emptiness that's behind it, why on earth would you feel passionate about what the future has to hold? The only thing that I can think of hearing this is terror. That's all I can feel right in this exact moment. I don't really feel that way, but I got to understand why someone might be thinking, wait a minute, this is sounding pretty grim.
Part of the, and I don't want to get over dramatic about it, but part of my rebirth, my reclamation of my whole self.
Yeah.
Is the commitment to living into my passion.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've discovered as my passion is what you said in your introduction to me, which is helping others identify, reconnect with, and live into their passion.
Mm.
And as I hear millennials for years now saying, that's what they're seeking. They're seeking, yeah, what is my purpose and how do I live into it? Yeah. And now in the Great Resignation, we're hearing people of all generations, yeah, say, yeah, that. How could I be anything but hopeful?
I love it. The discussions around the Great Resignation have historically, or at least as I'm seeing them, and this history obviously we're talking about is quite short, but the dominant narrative seems to be around what this represents from an employer perspective. How do you retain people more effectively? How do you be nimble from a human capital development and engagement perspective? How do people use their skills to leverage the labor favorable market right now to their advantage? You're positing that this is an opportunity for us to really dig more deeply. And if I'm hearing you correctly, you might even be saying that the Great Resignation, depending on what happens with it at least, could be a major cultural and spiritual touchstone in our society.
I more than believe it could be. I believe it will be and already is. In essence, and I'm going to paraphrase Michael White, who's managing director of a global architecture and design firm, who in essence said, employers are not going to determine the future of the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
The workforce is.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a significant, that you know, it's a world class, if you will, transformation of the future of work. And in transforming the future of work, it transforms the future of life beyond work as well.
Hearing statements like that, it's hard to truly fathom or appreciate, at least to my mind, the momentous nature of the times that we are living through right now. I, for one, consider it an opportunity too. Hearing this, watching this on YouTube, someone may say to themselves, you're right. My search for a new job could be a door opening to something greater. Or my lack of a meaning-based community that I can be part of is a sign that I need to engage in a bigger internal transformation. If there's one action that such a person could take today, what would that action be, Brian?
Breathe.
Stay alive, you mean?
No, I mean, sit down. Put your feet firmly on the ground. Lower your gaze, soften your gaze, close your eyes, and breathe. Even breaths, six count even breaths into your heart, into your head and into your gut, and listen to all of you and bring all of you into your day.
I love it. It's an action step that's doable, yet profound. Brian, how can people find out more about you?
So my website is transforminglives.coach. And you can reach me at Brian at transforminglives.coach.
And
that's Brian with an I.
Thank you. I'm glad you clarified that. And I'm sure a lot of people will. Brian, it has been great taking a ride with you today. Thank you so much for joining us. And for everyone tuning in, if you like this episode, please be sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple or a comment on YouTube. And I shall see you next time for another trip down the purpose highway. When you're racing down the purpose highway, we want to make sure you're healthy and happy every step of the way. That's why we're proud to partner with It's Nola, 21st century plant-based healthy granola snack bites made with real ingredients and audacious flavor. It's Nola crafts small batch hand-rolled granola balls that are vegan, gluten-free, and naturally low in sugar. It's Nola's delightful bites come in three flavors: luscious cranberry coconut, sassy mango masala, and dark, decadent, chewy chocolate. It's Nola is available to both individual customers and for wholesale accounts at itsnola.com. That's itsnola.com. Guests on this show are already enjoying this delicious snack. Check out It's Nola's website for yourself and find out how good it is.